Teresa also is an amazing woman who previously has worked as Obama's lawyer in his first term and is now starting a nonprofit at MIT to use technology for social emergence, and also just an incredible heart of a person who has been also, you know, on the volunteering end of these calls. So Preeta, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, I'm really excited about this conversation today. I find, as somebody who's been trained as a lawyer, so much of the use of words and language is often about making a point and kind of trying to communicate one's own point of view. And to be able to step back and realize that so much of what you can offer the world is just deep listening. And in some ways, the way you empower people is not by what you say, but by giving them the full space and letting them and completely hearing what they have to say. You transform not only them, but yourself. And so, you know, I call this to friends of mine, my own process of trying to transform communication and going into this deep listening mode. I call this my own de-schooling of myself. Because I think the ways in which we've been schooled have been a different use of language. And so I'm really excited to hear about Bob's journey. And just to give you a little bit of background about him, he has, for the past 20 years, created constructive conversations. He's involved with an organization called the Public Conversations Project in the greater Boston area. And they focus on really repairing communities and helping to repair communities along divisive issues, so issues such as sexual orientation, religion, abortion, gender, social class, race, and other divisive issues. Bob is kind of a trainer of trainers. He's developed methods, and then he really has propagated them through his training. He trains other senior practitioners in a practice that we're going to talk about called reflective structured dialogue that draws upon family therapy models, and he provides consultation to academic, civic, and religious leaders. A lot of his work focuses extensively on communities of faith, working to transform conflicts locally within congregations and among different faith groups, nationally within the Episcopal Church House of Bishops and internationally with the Anglican Communion. Prior to his time with Public Conversations, I find it fascinating that Bob's background is actually in therapy. He received his master's of education in therapy. He had been a private practitioner in family therapy for more than 20 years before his time at Public Conversations. He's trained therapists, clergy, and natural helpers for 15 years. He served as the administrative supervisor of a clinical pastoral education program, and he was for 7 years the clinical consultant to his advanced pastoral counseling practice. He also kind of has an interesting personal background, and perhaps we'll have some time to talk about that. In addition to, as I said, his prior career as a therapist, where he worked with the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health and other institutions, he also trained as went through the Evangelical Ministry Training Program and then turned away from that and decided to pursue his healing work in other domains. So, and as part of that, in between between high school and college, he helped found and lived on a commune. So kind of fascinating set of experiences, which I'm looking forward to getting into with him. So welcome, Bob, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I thought we could just start a little bit by, you know, starting currently on the work you do around community and public dialogue. The work you do with regard to repairing communities through dialogue, and then we can kind of work backward and talk a little bit about your journey and how you got there. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about repairing communities through dialogue.
Sure. Well, we get involved in situations where there's a group of people that have experienced some kind of division around things like race, gender, sexual orientation, Israeli-Palestinian issues, guns, science and faith, the list kind of goes on. And that division has started to separate people into camps. who find it increasingly difficult to engage with one another in constructive ways, not just about the issue, but perhaps about the life of the community as a whole. And once those sides form and solidify and start to create their own patterns of language, they start to determine in that community what can be spoken and what can't be spoken, what stories are told and retold. And unfortunately, the stories that are told and retold usually serve to deepen the divides. And at the end of that process, whatever bonds of affiliation held people together often unravel, and folks hit a dead end. So we get called in situations like that, and our general purpose, our overriding purpose, is to help people come to better levels of understanding, respect, empathy, and ability to communicate with one another. And typically the way we go about affecting that is to work with a subgroup of people from that that community to map the territory, sort of get a sense of what everybody's idea is about the history, the current challenges, the problem story, but also one of the great quotes of Thich Nhat Hanh, what's not broken. We really want to learn what characterized the healthy functioning of this community so that we can help them remember that and draw on that. And so we work with these folks to understand the situation, to create the best plan for their engagement, to help them prepare to communicate differently than they did before. And then we get together, facilitate one or more meetings, anywhere from one evening session or one day session to multiple years of work. And then, of course, we want to evaluate how things went and figure out if there are going to be next steps.
So maybe to make this a little more concrete, maybe we could just jump to you're describing a current community you're working with and just an example of how that work happens and who brings you in and kind of how you proceed.
Sure. So I'm going to speak about what I know best, which is the particular projects that I've been involved in. I encourage people to check out our website, publicconversations.org, for much more in-depth information about projects that our other colleagues have been involved in, which are, I think, really more impressive than the work that I've done, but I will talk about my work. I think a good example, it's kind of a small example, but it's a powerful example, where we have a college here in northeast Massachusetts, Gordon College, which has been having very public and deep struggles and controversy around the issue of conservative Christian faith and homosexuality. It had really divided the campus and created a lot of animosity. So we were brought in first to actually talk in secret with a couple of planning team members to see if it might be possible to have a constructive conversation. And we worked with them to create a retreat to which 9 faculty and administration came from the different ends of the theological spectrum and perspectives on homosexuality. We invited them to talk about themselves in ways that they hadn't before, to help each other understand how their faith journey and their personal experiences have woven together to lead to their perspective on their faith and on the issue of human sexuality. At the end of that retreat, the deal was that it was all confidential and there was no expectation that anything else would come of this other than better communication, better understanding, better empathy, etc. But at the end of it, I usually say to people, okay, you've signed on for nothing other than what you've done. Is there anything else that you want to do now that you've had this experience? And in this case, to a person, they said, we want to tell the campus about what's happened here because it's so powerful. We understand things about each other that even though we've been working together in some cases for 30 years, we never knew before. And that shapes how we relate to each other. So we want to talk about that. So they had their own faculty training session where they brought other faculty members in. Each person talked about their experience, and then they let other faculty members in a mini dialogue. So that's an example of starting very small and very quiet, moving through a process of helping people in a very structured and safe way to engage each other, and having the end result be that this small group of people wants to go on and influence the larger community. I think sometimes if we had tried to make that end result happen, it would sort of guarantee that it wouldn't.
Right.
But oftentimes people are so transformed by even a small experience of being in dialogue that they want to bring it into their world.
So maybe this would be a good time to talk about what is that structured dialogue approach, the substance of how you encourage or lead people or, you know, kind of spur them to be able to converse with one another in a way they might not have otherwise.
Sure. So we call our approach reflective structured dialogue. And I'll say a little bit about the ideas that we have about how things get stuck, what sort of shapes these conflicts and keeps them going, and then talk about the components of reflection, structure, and engagement. People often ask what we call the so what question, or why bother? Why bother to focus on conversation when there are so many other big things going on? And for us, we understand that in order for people to be in community, they need to be in relationship with one another. That's kind of obvious. But that relationship can't happen unless people are talking to each other. They have to be in conversation. So the power, the quality of that conversation is going to drive the quality of relationship and the quality of community. So we choose to focus on conversation and how that happens. We also understand the power of language, as you were mentioning earlier. The power of language to shape, particularly to shape the story of the conflict, but more importantly, to shape the story that's told about the other. And then that starts to drive how the other is seen. So we find that when people sort of separate into these camps, that the conversations get stuck, the stories get stuck and rigid, and the relationships suffer. Once those patterns are laid down, they're very difficult to break. I always think about, you know, we are based on family therapy and our experience as family therapists, although we are influenced by a lot of other experiences. But I like to say, when people ask me about this, how does it translate in regular life? I don't know about you folks, but I can go back home to a meal with folks that I may only see once a year, and if somebody brings up a certain subject at the dinner table, it's almost predictable that a switch has been flipped, and I can tell you how the conversation is going to go from that point on. Most of us have these patterns that have a tenderness that starts a process of conversation that can be very difficult to undo. So we want to make sure that we don't start those patterns of conversation in our work. We want to help folks understand and prevent the patterns that have really, encircled them or carried them and prevented them from responding with intention rather than being carried along on sort of automatic responses to other people. So what we invite people into is a process that will help them listen in new ways, become curious about the other, to speak, think, feel in expanded ways, resulting in expanded stories. So boiling it all down, I talk about the six P's as hallmarks of our work when we get involved in a community. Purpose, people, prevent, promote, plan, prepare. First thing we want to do is help people clarify and articulate the overarching purposes of their community and the purposes of a process that they want to be involved in, that then will guide everything else that's done. Once the purpose is clear, then we want to get a sense of what people should be there in order to accomplish that purpose. What voices need to be heard? What voices have been kept on the outside, maybe, that need to be brought in? And then also trying to understand what are the behaviors and patterns that should be prevented, that have continued to perpetuate the division? And on the other hand, what from the past has worked well that we want to promote, or what new listening, speaking behaviors do we want to invite into the room? Once we have a sense of that, we can work with folks to plan a process, which includes talking together about agreements or covenants, behavioral agreements or covenants that will govern how they speak with each other in order to affect the kinds of purposes that they want to. And probably the biggest distinguishing factor, I think, of our approach from other approaches is the last P, which is prepare. And for us, that means obviously we need to prepare a meeting design and things like that, but we really invest in helping people prepare themselves for a different kind of engagement. And we do that by inviting people into reflective experiences, whether that's through the questions that we ask them in an interview in advance of a meeting, or questions we give them through an email that are just for their reflective purposes, questions that we encourage people to ask one another. All these come together to help people prepare for a different way of engaging the other when they come into the room. And then
So you do this background preparatory work where you give people questions to think about, reflect, kind of maybe connect with their own story a bit. And then what's the structured part of the conversation or the dialogue?
So if we're doing a single session dialogue, and multiple sessions have these components too, but I'm going to walk you through a single session. We want to have some way of people greeting and engaging each other before they have the dialogic conversation that's oriented around food, if at all possible. So we hope to have people eat together, whether it's a full meal or some kind of refreshment, so that they can talk together about things of interest that are not related to the issue at hand. And one might think of it as a sort of a breaking of the ice, but it's also a way of connecting.
Is that kind of like a cocktail party type setting where they're just talking one-on-one, or is that in a group they're sitting together and having one conversation?
If the group has the resources to have a meal, it's great to have everybody sitting together to have a conversation, and sometimes that conversation will be guided. In the case of that I mentioned earlier of Gordon College, I asked people to talk about how their faith journey intersects with their commitment to be involved with the college, and to talk a bit about their journey and their teaching or administrative responsibilities over a meal or as part of a meal. Preferably as a group, but if we only have an opportunity to have light refreshments, people mill around and just talk to each other, and we encourage people to talk to folks that they know less in a situation like that. Typically, no, not a cocktail party. We discourage alcohol.
I meant just that setting. Sorry, that kind of one. Okay, the, so you have,
I'm an
so you break bread.
So it would be very common for people to start out in our world with some wine, but we don't do that. And then we shift gears, and in a perfect world, we have people actually go into a different room that's already set up with chairs in a circle, and we seat people, if we can, pro-con, or, you know, on opposite sides of an issue if they're our opposite sides. And because we want to avoid physically, this is part of where the structured thinking comes into play. There are physical structures that maintain the flow of conversation. If you look at the way things are set up often on television, they're set up with sides. So people are on one side and the other. And that physically reinforces a polarization. So we want to break that down by the way we arrange the room so that people in one perspective are not all sitting together. So folks come in, take their seats, and we make sure that everybody's on board with the stated purposes that they all have known in advance, and if they need to be edited, we will work to do that. We describe what's going to happen during the evening so that there's no mystery, and then we talk together about the agreements or covenants that have been made, which everybody will have seen in advance, and work to edit those if need be. And there's typically things like, no, we will not interrupt each other. We'll allow each other to finish speaking. We will not use judgmental language. We will refrain from attempts to persuade. We'll stick by time limits, things like that. And then we move into the really most highly structured part of a dialogue, which are a series of often three questions, which we call opening questions, questions which are designed to open new conversation by putting fresh information into the room. And those questions are preceded by a time of reflection. People will have a time-limited speaking so that it democratizes the exchange. And time is either kept by the facilitator or by passing a watch or some other timekeeping instrument. So we'll put out a first question, and it might be something like, can you tell us how your personal experience has led to your perspective on abortion? And people will pause, think, take some notes for themselves so that they're clear about their own speaking, and then respond in a go-around fashion with a pause between each person to sort of let one sentence end before the other begins. And the facilitator will not be involved in drawing people out or anything like that. It's just you go around the circle. And then we shift into question two, which is often something on the order of, can you tell us what's at the heart of the matter for you? And obviously relevant to the issues at hand. And again, a time limit, a go-around, pauses between people, and reflection beforehand. As people are going around the circle, we encourage people who are listening to be taking notes of keywords, things that they want to check out later with the person who's speaking, areas of curiosity, or assumptions that they feel are coming up that they're aware of that they want to check out. And then a third round of inquiry, which is something on the order of, within your overall commitment and perspective, commitment to your perspective, are there areas where one thing you care about bumps up against another, one value rubs up against another, areas of more complexity or gray areas that you'd be willing to share? And a similar process, or we may at that point ask people to just go as they're led, and then facilitator keeps time. So as people are listening, they're taking notes, taking sort of just keywords while they're listening, and they're preparing to preparing for a less formal and structured exchange in the next section, which we call questions of genuine interest, where we invite people to ask questions of each other that invite the other to say more about what they've already spoken about. And we do a little coaching about that. So no questions to unmask, to defame, to expose, to teach. Questions that are really questions of genuine interest and curiosity. And this, for me, I think is one of the key points of our process. I'm a slogan guy. I like slogans and catchy phrases, partly because of teaching and partly because of early experience. And in this case, I talk about how the power of certainty. People, when they get involved in these conflicts, they become often very certain about who the other is and what they think. And when certainty comes in the door, curiosity goes out the window. And people become, it becomes really difficult to ask a question of an opponent that goes deep into that opponent's experience and perspectives. So in this section, we invite people to do that, to ask one another questions and respond to those questions in open and honest ways. And then we shift into a close, which has as a purpose an opportunity for people to recognize what they've contributed to the evening, what the effect of the evening has been on them. And I'm saying evening because we often do a lot of our work in the evening. And to say anything that they need to say in order to bring the time to a meaningful close. And then check in with them again about the agreements and confidentiality. And this is the point where I'll ask, if we've had a very tight confidentiality agreement, do you want to keep that or do you want to say something about this to the outside world?
Great.
So that's a single session dialogue. It gives you the components, and I think it walks you through the structured part. If we're moving forward and doing more work with a community, which is typically what we will do, we'll maintain some kind of structure as we go forward, but also have more open exchange as people move on down in their experience with each other. The interesting thing to me, I did a project once. It was a 3-year project with a group of international bishops and archbishops from the Anglican Communion. 3 retreats over 3 years, and after the first couple of days of the first retreat, I thought, they probably want to let go of all the structure. And in fact, I said, no, we want part of every meeting to have this structured process. We want to begin every meeting with the structure, and they did for the next, 2.5 years. And then we want to shift into less formal exchange. But we feel that the structure invites us all to get our voices on the table before we start, to exchange.
Great. And I think you mentioned to me before that some of the engagements you have done are obviously multi-year engagements, oftentimes abroad. You've talked about work that your organization does, and I think among faith communities in Nigeria and elsewhere.
Yeah. One of the most exciting, I think, projects that's ever been done at Public Conversations has been done with our colleague, Dave Joseph, who we've been lucky enough to have with us now for some years. And Dave comes with a rich background in mental health and also in mediation, and works very closely with Mediators Beyond Borders as a senior member of that group, and is one of our senior practitioners. And Dave has been working with the Interfaith Mediation Center in Kaduna, Nigeria, which was set up by a Christian pastor and a Muslim imam who were combatants in the battles that have been going on between Christian-Muslim factions in that country for many years. They were combatants who decided to lay down their arms and work for peace through their faith traditions and set up this center. Dave's been working with staff there, and actually one of our former staff in the office, Seth Karamagi, is on site in Nigeria supporting the work of dialogue there. Dave has been training practitioners to go into communities and facilitate conversations between Christians and Muslims to work for peace and avoid violence. And there are some really terrific stories about the effect that that training has had on the folks that have been able to be reached in Nigeria. So that's, I think, one of our most exciting pieces of work, but there are many.
Great. So let's go a little bit into your story. There's so much more we could talk about, and I'm sure it'll come up in Q&A. There's just so much about the public conversation work that's fascinating. It reminds me in some ways of actual circle practice that you see in kind of restorative justice circles and in native communities. But let's talk a little bit about your journey. What drew you? You had a long career as a therapist and a mental health counselor. What drew you personally to this kind of dialogue work after that period of time of working to repair individuals?
Yeah, while I was doing work as a therapist, I was also had a lot of other responsibilities. So earlier in my career, I was an outreach worker as a mental health counselor on one of the first mobile psychiatric early intervention and prevention teams in the country. And in that work, I was in neighborhoods, in workplaces, in projects, seeing how the social structure around people could support them or contribute to their challenges. And so we started to work with the natural helping systems of who are the people in the project, for instance, that somebody went to for help? Who are the helpers in the community, like barbers and hairstylists and bartenders that people told their problems to? So it was in that experience that I started to discover that professional helping was great, and I was making money on it, so I wasn't going to defame it, but that really the communities that surrounded people could work for good or ill. So I got very, very interested in the notion of healing community. And my career started to morph into training, being a trainer and a training director, and the position that I had before I came to Public Conversations as training director for a foundation that helps homeless families was the direct connection with Public Conversations. I was working mostly in communities of color around the country in urban environments, training staff of family shelters, homeless shelters. And I had gotten a lot of training in models of diversity and gender sensitivity, sexual harassment, etc. And I functioned well, I have to say, I think. But it didn't, there's something missing. The approaches that I was learning at that time, this was back in the 80s, were often premised on the starting point of making somebody wrong and re-educating them. And that has value, but it did not change relationships, in my opinion. It certainly wasn't working that way for me. So
it's interesting. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
It's interesting, the relationship between the kind of self and the group and the community. One of our reflections that somebody, Rhonda, submitted before the call talked about, you know, that in order to have a genuine dialogue with someone else, I have to first be aware of the dialogue I'm having with myself. And am I operating from a space of scarcity or abundance? You know, and what am I bringing to each of my interactions with the other? So it's interesting. In your career, you focused initially on work with individuals and helping them to, you know, in some sense, go through their own healing journeys, and that led you to the view of the embedded self and the role of the community. And anyway, it's just I'd be curious about your reaction to that reflection about, you know, the extent to which, at the end of the day, the dialogue does come down to how people are feeling in their own journey and where they are in their own self-awareness.
I think it's a reciprocal process. We reflect about our own journey and inner process to prepare for dialogue, and then as we engage the other, we discover more about ourselves. We discover more about our journey, things that we maybe didn't think were connected. We discover more about the range of possibilities that we have for feeling for the other and for thinking, and how things are connected to the ways we engage the other. So I do think that the dialogue with yourself is an important piece, but I also think it's one that begins internally, perhaps, and then is quickly modified by the engagement we have with other people in the dialogue.
That's fascinating. Going back even further in your journey,
well,
even
can
before.
I just say one more thing before we go back further.
Oh, sure, of course.
About the because I just want to bring us into PCP. When I took the first course that PCP offered, and in the first session, I was floored by people being asked to speak from their identity and not being criticized for it. And essentially what I felt was having a place of honor created for who people were. And it just blew all my circuits. I'd never seen anything like it before. I'd never experienced anything like it before. I got religion, I suppose, the religion of dialogue, and went out and tried it out in the field after the first session and found it deeply transformative and powerful. So I was hooked and felt that I'd found something unique and powerful and different that was going to benefit people, who are trying to relate to each other across divides.
Great. So going even further back, before you became a therapist and mental health counselor, what drew you personally? I'd love to hear a little bit about your personal journey. What drew you to the work of healing and repairing people and communities?
Yeah. I grew up with a single dad in the 50s and in the 60s. And at that time, it was so uncommon that it was stigmatized. So our family was stigmatized, and I was on the outside looking in on a lot of things in our community, in school and community life. So I think I had a sensitivity to other people who might have been hurting. And then a couple of key things happened to me. I was helped by a healing community. It was a little tiny church that took me aside when I was a teen and fed me and gave me clothes and just loved me. And I experienced the power of the healing community, and then had the opportunity through that to be involved with a city mission and my first mentor, Mr. Art Billups, who started to teach me about what it meant to minister to people and to care for people's physical, mental, and spiritual needs. And I was young. I was 14. So I had the experience of doing that, and then met another pivotal person, Tom Skinner, who was an evangelist, African-American, former gang member, who started to teach me about race and engaging with people from other races and asking questions first. He said, "You're not scratching where we itch in your suburban American churches, because you don't ask what really is needed." That was my first introduction to starting first with inquiry. I'm still working on it. And then the last thing that I'll say about the early times is that all of that early experience led to creating a Christian commune. This is back in the Jesus Movement era, when a lot of us had long hair and beards. So we created this group of folks who did a lot of social justice work as well as social service work with runaway kids on bad trips, people who were poor and in need of food and clothing, place to stay, in addition to ministering to spiritual needs. Through that, discovered the need for some professional help, that a lot of the folks that we were working with needed a lot more than what we could give them, and that led me to go on to be a helper myself and to get educated. So,
great.
Okay, so, Rita, if I may, before you ask your next question, prompt all the callers, all of us on the call, if you have a question that you would like to ask or if you have a thought to share, then please press *6 on your phone, and that will get you on the call queue. If you'd like to email us your thought or a question, you're welcome to do that as well. And the email address is ask@servicespace.org. I see that we have a couple of questions in the queue, and I'll get to that maybe after a question or two from you, Preeta. So sorry for the interrupt, and please go ahead with your next question.
That's fine. I'll just wrap up with this, then we'll get to the callers, and maybe I'll intersperse a little bit here and there. So you talked about how when you first kind of were exposed to public conversations, how you kind of got religion, I think is the phrase you used, about dialogue. I'd love to hear, given your own healing journey, your work with healing others, how has your work with communities on dialogue transformed you in terms of your own personal communication style, maybe your own views about the other and how you engage with them?
I think there are a combination of a couple of things here, one of which I haven't mentioned in terms of my personal journey, but it figures in. I married a Jewish woman and raised our children as Jews. And I am not. I am Christian affiliated, but my children are Jewish. And as a result of the combination of being involved with public conversations and having Jewish children, I became much more sensitive to how divisions are perpetuated in small as well as large ways through conversation, through structures and processes in schools and things like that. So that led me, the two things coming together led me to become much more vocal in the schools of my children about practices that I thought were potentially or actually discriminatory. It also led me to be much more involved, I think, vocally in my local community around those issues. Internally, at home, I like to say dialogue is like a spiritual path. It's, you know, we're on it. We're never at the end of it, and I'm certainly not at the end of it. I am walking along and stumbling as I go and getting up and taking a few more steps. And I think that the Dialogic Practices of Public Conversations Project have enabled me to be more curious than I otherwise would be. And when we get stuck, I get stuck in a loop, or I have a concern. And I think, more willing to listen than I was previously to the experiences of people in my family and the perspectives of people in my family and accord them the respect that they deserve. And I brought dialogic practice into the communities that I've been involved in, particularly my communities of faith. We've brought dialogue practices into governance, into leadership orientation and training, things like that. So those are some of the areas that I think where it's affected me.
Great. So, Devin, do you want to open up the queue?
Sure. I love the thought, that dialogue is like a spiritual path. You are on it, but never at the end of it. And how thoughtful and how insightful. We have a couple of questions or comments over the email, Bob. Okay. And first of them is from Stephen Buckley from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And he's sharing, Bob, in the very beginning, you are trying to help folks understand the patterns of conversation. That is, understand and appreciate reflective, structured dialogue. Are you then, even at that early point, using RSD, which I think is reflective structured dialogue, in talking with them about having a good talk with others?
So I think I'm hearing the question as, do we embody the practice of reflective structured dialogue when we're engaging the folks before a dialogue actually happens? Would that be correct?
Yes, I think so, too. That's what I understand as well.
I would say that in the stance that we take as facilitators is a collaborative and a curious stance. So in that way, yes, I think we're trying to embody the principles and the orientation that we hope people have toward each other when they go into the dialogue room. In terms of actual practice, we certainly don't ask people to respond with time limits and have agreements before they talk with us. But it's more the spirit of engagement and the stance as a practitioner that we're bringing both to the person in advance and then into the room when we do a dialogue. Thanks for the question.
Sure. And thank you, Bob. And we have one more comment from a caller that is calling in from St. Louis. Thanks, Bob, for the great information. The process you describe sounds like it requires a lot of commitment to the process. That is sometimes easier for groups that are acculturated to such process. It reminds me of a presentation a former MA health director gave our College for Public Health about difference between class and socioeconomic status. She mentioned that as people entered the room, they clearly knew it was their job to sit down, greet each other, and wait for the program to start, but that isn't a norm or understanding of all groups. Could you address what you and your group do with very, for instance, the educationally or socially diverse groups where norms of how to work together may differ?
Sure. Great question. I think talking with people in advance helps all of us get those differences out on the table and talk together about how to honor them when we create the actual meeting structure and process. And I have to say, over the years, I've found that the differences are much less salient than I had expected them to be. And I'll talk to you about this in particular with regard to doing international work. We stayed away from doing international work for many, many years because we had this idea that because we're Western, Northeast United States, white generally group, at that time we were all white, that our practices would not translate to other indigenous cultures. And I remember I was confronted by a guy from Burundi who wanted to come and take one of our trainings, and we arranged to do some fundraising for him to come. And at the end of the training, he said, you have to be in my country. We have a real problem with people coming back from refugee camps after our genocide, and we need you to come and teach us. And I said, but we're so culturally different. And he said, well, that's not for you to decide. That's for us. So you come and teach us, and we will work with you to integrate the best of your approach with the best of ours. And I learned a lot in that moment. So that's really how we work now. We will meet with people at the local level and say, well, what are your ways? And how does this map onto your ways? And what's different? And how do you want to work with that?
Wow. That reminds me of that Indian talking stick principle that I read in Stephen Covey's book. And he's like, unless and until I actually completely understand you, I'm going to listen to you and you hold on to the stick. And really how insightful. We have a caller in our queue, and let's get to our next caller.
Hi, this is Kozo in Cupertino, and Bob, thank you so much for the work you do just to resolve these really deep-seated conflicts in our society and actually in our world. I have a question that, from elementary psychology, I hear this thing that 70% of communication is nonverbal. So I really love how you weave the participants together actually in the space by going pro-con, 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 pro-con. And I'm wondering if there's any other ways that you guys use or encourage nonverbal communication, whether that be, body language or posture or touch or, I can imagine just getting some of these opposite factions to just kind of touch each other on the elbow or something can make a profound change. And I'm wondering if you guys have looked into that or work any way in that manner.
It's a great question. And before I answer it, I just want to do a little shout out. You're in Cupertino, and you may be familiar with the Public Dialogue Consortium, which is based in Cupertino, who does really fantastic work. They've been around about as long as we have. And I highly recommend you investigating them if you don't know about them already. They're wonderful colleagues. So in terms of touch, a couple things. If you have people who are really at odds with each other and in some instances feel that the other is destroying the world by their perspective, they are really not interested in touching each other. But the reason that we seat people pro-con, pro-con, is that when we did our early work in abortion and we interviewed everybody after every session, one of the things we heard from people was, don't sit us on sides. Sit us pro-con, pro-con, close enough that if we wanted to touch each other, we could. We don't want to, but close enough that we could. So that's what we do. And in terms of the nonverbals, my colleague John Saroof, who's also doing terrific work in science and faith and some other areas, is an actor who used to have a professional career as an actor and a director, and has a lot of terrific theater exercises or theater thinking that he weaves into his work, which I am not capable of even grasping myself, much less doing. But the closest that I come in my work to directly working with nonverbals is inviting people to do walking meditation. And that can take different forms, but one form that it can take is to give people a reflective task and then have them walk in mixed pairs together for about 20 minutes across whatever landscape we happen to be located in. In one case, I was working with people from a State Department of Mental Health in a state building, and unfortunately, there was only the state building to walk through. But we sent people off in pairs to walk in silence for 20 minutes and just notice what they saw that was relevant to the reflective task that they had been given. And then to find a place to sit together after that 20 minutes of silence and just talk together about what they noticed, and then come back to the group and talk with all of us about it. And that being in rhythm together, that walking together, starts to shift how people engage each other in a way that, I know there are very sophisticated theories about this. I was just having lunch with somebody earlier in the week that was trying to explain why it works, and he lost me after about the second sentence. But it does seem to have a very powerful effect. The other thing about nonverbals is it's another thing that we want to talk with people about in advance in terms of how they know that people are dissing them or not paying attention to them, and how they know that they are, and to see if we can incorporate some of that knowledge into the agreements and the framing of the conversation. I hope that's an answer to your question.
Oh, yeah, great. Thank you for that. I love that idea of walking in silence in unison. You know, I mean, if that's nonverbal, if that's nonverbal communication, that's nonverbal dialogue, actually. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Kozo, for such an insightful question, and thank you, Bob, for answering that. So again, for all of our callers, if you have a question, you're welcome to press star 6 on your phone, and that will get you in the call queue. If you'd like to email us a question, you're welcome to do so by emailing us at askask@servicespace.org. And let's get to our next caller right now. Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me? Is that me in the line next?
Yes. Hi.
Hello. Hi. Good morning. And Bob, my name is Pallavi. I'm calling from San Jose. Thank you. There's so many openings in this conversation. I have possibly difficult and controversial question for you. I understand what you're saying about dialogue with the other opens us up to new perspectives. And, you know, there are many stories of, you know, somebody has killed someone and there's violence and a family member comes to a place of forgiving. My question is, I don't know if this is deeper or it might even trigger some of you on the call. You know, I'm how do I put this correctly? You know, in India, for instance, right now, I don't know if you're familiar, there is like a rape crisis on hand. And, you know, there was a very brutal rape a couple of years ago, and the person died from it. And it's almost like, you know, it's like the consciousness of the country rose in protest. And a documentary was released a few months ago, and again, there is this whole movement happening. Now, in situations like that, I have a sense that, you know, just dialogue isn't enough. It probably goes deeper into, you know, a community's maybe sexual psyche. Now, in situations like that, how would you approach situations like that, where, you know, there are deep-rooted triggers, you know, deep inside, and do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that question and that observation. Well, the first thing I would say in terms of going at depth and dealing with trauma, definitely dialogue is not indicated for all controversies and difficulties. And there's some instances where it's absolutely not indicated at all. I can, you know, speak from experience as a therapist that there are plenty of instances where dialogue with the opponent would not be the right thing, because it would do much, much more damage than it would be constructive. So we have actually turned down work that we think would be more damaging to the folks to bring them together, just because ethically we feel that we wouldn't want to be part of that process. And I'm thinking in particular, and here in the Boston area, that the sex abuse scandal in the Roman Catholic Church started with the revealing abuse that had happened here in our region. And we were invited early on to broker conversations between perpetrators and victims. And we did not feel that that could be done in any way that would be constructive, so we decided not to get involved. But there are people, I have to say, you know, having said that, there are people who do that work, who bring victims and perpetrators together, and do it with great effect. But even they would say that not all of those situations are amenable to that process. So we talk about ripeness, R-I-P-E-N-E-S-S, ripeness, whether a situation is ripe for dialogue or another process is indicated. So we have so many other terrific processes for engaging the opponent, and we have other processes for demanding justice and social justice. And we honor that when there is situations like they're happening in India, when we have situations that are happening in the United States. There are times when we need to raise our voices and demand change. and certainly we want to do it in a way that we're going to be heard, but I would say that dialogue in the case of what's happening in India may not be the best match for a social change process there.
So one follow-up thought on this, you know, something you said at the beginning of the call really hit me right center, which was you said, you know, what gets, not just what gets spoken, what doesn't get spoken, but the stories get retold.
Yeah.
So in situations like this, if the trauma is not addressed, you know, it possibly carries forward generations.
Yes.
Right.
So the question is, what's the best way to address that? What's the most effective way to complexify the stories that are told about people? And dialogue is not the only means to that. Search for Common Ground, an organization that's based in Washington but works worldwide, did some terrific pioneering work in South Africa to counter apartheid. And the way they did that was they worked with songwriters to create popular music. They worked with movie producers. They worked with the media. They worked in a lot of different ways. And basically, they worked with the storytellers to be able to tell different stories. And so I think we need to be looking at that. We need to be looking at dialogue as one means, but I think we all need to be looking at what are the stories that are out there, and to stand up and bear witness when stories are false or partial or used to oppress and imprison and kill other people.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So that's a great – sorry, this is Preeta. I was going to follow up a little bit on that question. It's an interesting example. So, like, when you're talking about a situation like that where you have, you know, maybe members of the community that are subject to violence, apart from an individual rape case, which may not be appropriate for dialogue, but in terms of a community awareness of a practice that may be hurting particular members of a community, and I guess I'm just wondering if you were to, is that also something you think is not necessarily ripe for dialogue? Like the fact that after a celebrated instance of violence, the fact that some people might be coming and saying, oh, well, women who dress a certain way are asking for it. You know, is there an educative function that can be played or a healing function that can be played in a community dialogue not tied to a particular case?
Yeah, I think so. And so now that I've said what I said about dialogue not being matched, I'm going to give you a couple examples where dialogue was used and is being used very effectively in deeply, deeply traumatized communities. And it gets at the observation that you just offered and the question you've asked. I told you earlier about getting involved in Burundi. And Burundi, the situation was that people were coming back from refugee camps to return to their hometowns to find that, in some instances, people who had killed their families had taken their houses. And they had to all figure out how they were going to live together and how they were going to address history of trauma that they had experienced. And dialogue, the creation of their own independent model of dialogue that incorporated their tradition as well as enabled people to tell their stories, was a very effective way of bringing people together to tell their stories, to witness one another, and then to decide how they're going to move forward. Another example that I'd like to share is I'll again talk about the work of Dave Joseph, in this time in Liberia. Liberia, you all know, had horrible war, using a lot of child soldiers who were conscripted and forced to do things, horrible things. Once the war was over, and those child soldiers, former child soldiers, started to come back from the refugee camps, they were stigmatized to the extent that they did not want to let people know that they had been child soldiers. And Dave and Mediators Beyond Borders created a dialogue process for these returning folks to integrate them, who, of course, they're not children anymore, they're in their 20s or so, to help them integrate back into their communities and find meaningful employment. And one of the participants who had decided not to speak of a background as a child soldier at the end of the dialogue process did speak about that and said, in summary, if we had had dialogue, we may not have had to have civil war. So I think that it can serve a community education function as well as an individual function and a community shaping function. But we don't set out to have that as an objective. There are other forms of dialogue that are really great that have a social education function built into them. I'm thinking particularly of intergroup dialogue, which is based at University of Michigan, sustained dialogue in D.C., Hal Saunders' approach that has been used very effectively and has an education as well as an engagement function. It's not the case for our particular orientation and model of dialogue, but it does happen.
Great conversation and great questions, and thank you for your share, Pallavi and Preeta. Love your question on the topic as well. Let me get to our next caller in the queue.
Hi, this is Elisa, and I'm north of Seattle in the Skagit Valley. And in some ways, you just answered my question, but I guess maybe there's a little bit more to it. What I was, in listening to everything you said, which is phenomenal, I was wondering that if there was a transformation that you perceived from people who had gone through this process, that the curiosity or the ways of maybe not being so much in conflict kind of rippled out in an effect after people went through these processes, so they did not their way of actual communication changed, or at least there was a place in them where there was a receptivity. There wasn't so much reactionariness. Does that make sense?
So now that I have a lot of white hair, sometimes I have trouble following a sentence from the beginning to the end.
Okay.
Back to the beginning and just do the preface and helpful for me.
Okay. So basically my question, and I'm sorry I had to come to work while this conversation was going, which might make me not so clear. But my question is that when people go through this process, which is a phenomenal process, and in this process there is deep listening and there is curiosity and there are places of learning and growing that happen to the individuals, have you perceived that there is a change amongst how these people behave afterwards? Or I don't know if behave or perceive is a better word, afterwards.
Our answer to that question is more anecdotal than based on solid longitudinal research.
Okay.
If there are any funders out there that would like to bankroll us to do longitudinal research, we would gladly accept your money. But anecdotally, I would say a very resounding yes. One of the things that people get so excited about when they participate is that they've found new ways to communicate and connect with each other, and they want to do more of it. So they bring it into their staff meetings, for instance. They bring it into the ways that they engage each other in the hallway. And sometimes they spread it out through their whole organizations. When we worked with this group I mentioned earlier of bishops and archbishops from the Anglicans. They had no commitment to do anything at the end. They wrote a letter, which ultimately the Archbishop of Canterbury sent out to the entire Anglican communion around the world, in which they said, we should be using dialogue as a way to engage conflict and not do it the way we tend to do it. And here are the hallmarks of dialogue. And folks who participated in that then brought that process back to their home countries and in many instances changed the ways that their church in their country engaged difficulties and divisions. And we hear one of the most common things we hear when people participate in a dialogue is how things change at home. I went home last night and I spoke with my husband in a way that I never have before. And I spoke to my children. This is what happened to me, actually. I talked earlier about that first session of public conversations. I came home that night, and my wife was waiting for me with my two children who were, I think they were probably 5 and 3 at that time. They'd been arguing. And sort of at her wit's end, and said, okay, see what you can do here. And I used some simple... This is a simple thing that I learned about giving each a time limit to speak and only speaking about what they wanted. And they, you know, resolved their conflict. And I was struck with the power of that. So long way of saying yes.
That was the answer I was hoping for. Thank you. I want to learn more about what you do.
Let me ask you a quick question. In your neck of the woods, there used to be a terrific program that had to do with the King Salmon, organized by a terrific practitioner, Shirley Solomon, that involved kitchen table dialogues. And have you been involved in that at all?
I have not, but I will look it up.
Yeah, check it out. I'm not sure if it still exists, but I know they were doing some really terrific work.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a great question. And this is so insightful for me as well, Bob. Communication is such a big part of what I do. And I have one thought and one question for you as well, Bob. And one thing that I have experienced myself is whenever there is that candid openness in the room where people feel they are understood and the conversation is about the topic on the table and not about any other preoccupation, suddenly the spontaneity comes into the conversations and it just opens up and the problem that could not be solved for a month, sometimes just kind of like aha moment, and we just start talking about it. Now, I would love to see if you have stories around that, like in your program or from your experiences. If you'd like to tell us a story or two about it, I think that'll be awesome.
And just, again, just give me the very brief, the kind of story that you're hoping I will tell.
A story where, for example, in your program, you started with someone and it took a little bit of time, for example, before things would start rolling in. But then what was the aha moment and how it turned around and people started talking and, like, good things happened quickly after that?
Yeah. Love the aha moments. Let's see. I was working, our work with homosexuality and Christian faith started in the Episcopal Diocese of Massachusetts in 1997. And in the process of the early work, there were two people who were at the far ends of the theological spectrum on this issue, and they represented different identities in terms of their sexual orientation. And after a couple of meetings, one person turned to the other and said, you know, I really have a hard time with how you think, but I love you. And that moment was previously unimaginable, and then went on to drive the work that that group did, which grew from meeting together for a few sessions to creating a guide for congregations that want to engage this issue, a comprehensive workbook and guide for multi-session conversations on this issue. But I think that that was a key point where at least those two folks had an awakening toward each other that started to shape the process.
Wow, wow. Thank you for sharing that, Bob. And we have one more question from Sarah Patrick, and she's from St. Louis, Missouri. And I stand corrected. I think earlier I said St. Louis, Montana. So it's not Montana, but Missouri. And the question is, could you share an example of how you redirect or correct when someone does not follow the rules of dialogue?
Sure. Typically, you know, we all have a little bit of different ways to do this, but there are two core approaches, at least that I use, and one of them is borrowed from my colleague Dave Joseph. I often think of one of my favorite movies of all time is Fiddler on the Roof. For those of you that are familiar with that movie, you know that one of the main characters is Tevye, and there's a part in Tevye where he's doing on the one hand, on the other hand. And I think of Tevye when a dilemma comes up in a dialogue where people have departed from a ground rule. So I'll say, you know, on the one hand, you've committed to this agreement for this particular purpose. On the other hand, what I'm observing right now really doesn't square with that commitment. So let's talk about how either you can reform your behavior in the moment to live into that commitment, or whether we need to change your agreement about that. So that's one way of dealing with it. Dave, I think, has a much better and way to help people, and also to teach facilitators how to do this. And it's PSA. Or SPA, depending on how you want to arrange the letters, where you notice that there's been a slip from the agreement. You talk about the purpose that that agreement has, and then talk together about what alternative response a person might make in order to observe that purpose for that agreement.
Okay, so I'm a little slow today, so P is for the purpose and A is for the alternative.
Correct.
Options in PSA. Okay, perfect.
Yes, and S is for the slip. And I love that because trainees get that right away. Even when we work with high school students, freshman high school students, which we just have been doing some work with, they get that right away and they can do it. So that's another way of engaging that.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for that question, Sarah, and thank you for an insightful answer, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Harpreet, would you like to ask your question?
Yeah, so just to close it off, thanks a lot, Bob. Amazing conversation. I'm really, really excited about the work you do. Really extraordinary work in terms of just really being down in there with communities and helping them talk to one another. I guess you have another project, which I also find very fascinating, which is the Family Dinner Project.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could just, you know, as we close this off, because I think it connects, I think, in part to your work with communities and your interest in helping with communities, I'd just love to hear a little bit about that and how that
sure.
maybe connects to your broader sense of how you can help communities.
Sure. Well, I'll say the connectedness thing first, because if we go back to what I said earlier about the connection between conversation and community, and if we think of a family as a community, and that conversation drives the relationships that family members are able to have with one another. Focusing on the kinds of conversations that people have is really important. And one place where people reliably have conversation in families is around the meal table. So we focus on that as a place where a lot of learning, change, and growth can happen within a family. We were very fortunate to be sought out by Shelley London, the founder, who was a retired corporate executive, with several other groups and people to just brainstorm how could we make family dinner a more productive experience for people across the country and around the world? And we started experimenting with bringing people together in community dinners and talking with them about their meals and what they would like to improve and ideas that they had for other people and how to meet challenges. And doing a lot of research, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Anne Fischel on our team, who has just written a terrific book about family dinners. And based on her research and research that other people have done, that shows the power that family dinners have to improve, particularly to improve the lives of young people. We created this fledgling project in 2010. And it's now grown to quite a vital project that has other institutional partners that are bringing more constructive family dinners to their constituents and helping us get the word out.
Great. That's fantastic. I think we're at the...
Can
I just interrupt you. one quick second? Because I just want to because I did mention Dr. Anne Fischel, I also want to let people know the title of her book, which is Home for Dinner, it's called.
Home for Dinner, okay.
Home for Dinner, Making Food Fun and Conversation for a Happier Family and Healthier Kids. And one more quick thing is that our Nuts and Bolts Guide to Dialogue, Fostering Dialogue Across Divides, 180 pages, is available for free on our website. If you go to our website and look under Resources and Guides, you'll have everything you wanted to know and more about organizing and facilitating a dialogue using our approach.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. So I will look it up on your website, and I'll make sure to include the link in the thank you note that I'll be sending out to all of our callers. In case if I have questions in finding it, maybe I'll drop you an email note.
Sure.
Bob, on behalf of all Sorry Space volunteers, I would like to ask, we always like to ask this question, how can we help you, like as part of the Sorry Space community and all of us volunteers, what can we do for you?
I think making people aware of the possibility of constructive conversation through dialogue is the most important thing. Getting the message out there that other ways of connecting are possible, and making people aware of the resources that are available through us. Obviously, people can, you know, hire us to do work, but more importantly, there are so many resources on our website that people can use to do their own dialogues in their communities. So making your constituents aware of those resources and having them spread the word would really be a gift to us.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. And I think I have linked to your website in the call profile that we have. And so for our callers, I will look it up and I'll make sure that I include that. And thank you, Bob, for pointing that out and being forthcoming, like in sharing it all with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. Namaste.
And thank you all for teaching and listening and for being curious. It's been a real honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.